This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On The Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
These are just anecdotes, but it's building up into something more coherent.
You know, I think it'd be interesting just to really try to unravel what his ties.
There's a sort of country-city divide.
They're inconvenient, and it's not clear where it goes next.
From One World Trade Center in Manhattan, this is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick.
At 7:20, the engines of the 60 helicopters started simultaneously with a thunderous roar and a storm of dust. After idling his engines for 3 minutes on the airstrip, our pilot raised his right hand in the air, forming a circle with his forefinger and thumb to show that he hoped everything would proceed perfectly from then on. The pilot's gesture was the only indication that the seven men were on their way to something more than a 9 o'clock job.
In January of 1967, a young reporter, not even a reporter really, just a 23-year-old kid, right out of college, arrived in Vietnam, a country he knew almost nothing about. And just a few days later, he found himself riding along with the largest ground operation of the war. We'll go deep inside Jonathan Schell's article, The Village of Ben Suk, a piece that helped to change how America saw the Vietnam War. That's coming up later. Now, long before she was a White House correspondent at the New York Times, Maggie Haberman was a local reporter for the New York Post and the Daily News, the tabloids that really get into the politics and personalities of New York City. Which is to say, she had a front row seat to the Donald J. Trump show for a very long time. Covering Trump as the leader of the free world, though, is something altogether different. The president sometimes isn't very happy with her, and in a moment of pique, he called Haberman a third-rate reporter. But it's clear that she's also earned his wary respect. Last week, when Trump went after his attorney general, Jeff Sessions, an astonishing public takedown that will end God knows how, it was Haberman and her colleagues from The Times who were in the room and got the story. I talked with Maggie Haberman last week. From outside, it seems like we're looking at a kind of Borgia-like court in which everybody is leaking on everybody. Nobody particularly likes anyone else. Everybody's suspicious of each other. And the atmosphere is generally poisonous. Is that inaccurate?
Yeah, I think that's 100% accurate. I mean, look, we're used to a team of rivals. We are not used to a team of the Bloods and the Crips, which is essentially what this is in the White House. I mean, these are rival gangs.
Who are the Bloods and who are the Crips? How does it work?
I think I'd need to add in some new gang names, too, because Bloods and the Crips makes it sound like there's only two teams. There's something like six. It's a lot. And I think that you have so many people who started out not trusting each other, you know, because you had people who either were pro-Trump during the campaign or who were part of the RNC during the campaign. And that has morphed into something, you know, much different and more complicated.
So break it down. What are the teams?
Look, you've got sort of the policy teams of the NSC and the NEC.
So this is the National Security Council, mm-hmm. and
and National Economic Council. Right. So you've got on the NSC side, you've got Henry H.R. McMaster. You know, Dean Appel works with him. NEC, you have Gary Cohen, the president's top economic advisor who came from Goldman Sachs. Dean Appel also works closely with him.
Also of Goldman Sachs.
Mm-hmm. Jared Kushner sort of touches on that. You've got these concentric circles. Then you have Steve Bannon, who doesn't really have direct reports and has, you know, I think been choosing to throw himself into fewer meetings than he used to. He's fairly closely aligned at this point with Reince Priebus, which is ironic because they really disliked each other early on. Priebus is seen pretty broadly as a weak chief of staff, and that is just an ongoing problem. And, you know, because, so here's a for instance. You have these theme weeks that this White House does. There's no through line. You know, there's Made in America Week, there's Energy Week, there's whatever. There's no sort of sense of unfurling a larger narrative here that you're trying to tell about this presidency from their comms team. It's just sort of throwing stuff at the wall, anything that it doesn't have the word Russia in it.
How does Donald Trump spend his day when not in routine meetings that are on his schedule?
This is really like the holy grail of reporting that has been sought and not completely answered for some time, including by me. Look, you know, he gets very irritated when we all report that he watches a lot of TV. He does watch a lot of TV. It doesn't seem like that's a massively controversial statement. But he doesn't like it when that is said because he thinks it's shorthand for saying he doesn't work that hard. He holds a lot of meetings, but his Oval Office is an incredibly open door room, unlike most Oval Offices, where really it is, you know, as you know, David, it's like it's the palace and the chief of staff is the gatekeeper. I mean, Trump's Oval Office is like Grand Central Station. People try briefing him and someone comes in and interrupts him. You know, people just sort of walk in without being previously announced in any meaningful way. He spends his day interacting is how I would describe it.
Now, over the course of time, what do you make out to be the ideology of Donald Trump? Or is it purely situational now after a half a year in office?
I think he has no clear ideology. I think he has a couple of base impulses that he has held on to since the 1980s when he was taking out those newspaper ads about how Japan is, quote unquote, ripping us off, right? I mean, a lot of the language that he used then is the same as what he uses now, but it's more of a feeling than an ideology. It's a sense that the United States is being taken advantage of. You know, he ran as a Republican, and he really appealed to this hard right base that believes in less government. But in reality, this is a man who grew up in Ed Koch's New York City, and I think has a very specific view of the role the government is supposed to play in people's lives.
What does that mean? We're on from coast to coast, as they say. What does it mean to have inherited, to some degree, Ed Koch's view of New York?
I think he fundamentally believes that the role of government is to provide for people. What exactly that looks like, I think, is where you end up getting into, you know, a bit of a different place with him. But I think that Trump generally believes, you have seen him talk about in various interviews where it has slipped out, his belief that everybody should have health care. Ultimately, this is a guy who, you know, sort of grew up in a city where the government was hugely accountable for policing, for getting the garbage off the streets, for the buildings you build. I mean, and I think that the role of government in people's lives in New York City in the 1980s was pretty liberal. And, you know, he's much more Trump, I think, at heart of a big government type than his fans might realize.
You recently described him on an Air Force One trip to Paris where he kind of held forth with the press. He was rather friendly. He was rather open. He was rather ebullient. And at the same time, he tweets about and gives speeches where he loathes the press. He is called the press. He's called us enemies of the people, a phrase that has roots in French Revolution and Stalin's Russia and all the rest. How does he really feel about the press?
Look, I think that he loves the press. I think he lives at least loosely by the theory that if not all press is good press, that most press is good press. I think he finds the press has been his nurturer and validator for 30 to 40 years, right? I mean, this is a person who courted the tabloids in New York City aggressively in the 1980s. He found a way to make himself a commodity for the gossip pages and play the tabloids off each other. He likes attention, and he likes media. You know, he loves to manipulate the media. He is a master at it. And he was also in a good mood, and I think he wanted us to see him in a good mood for whatever reason. So, you know, he spent an hour back there with us, which is a very long time for the president to be at the back of the plane.
You worked for Rupert Murdoch at a certain point, and
I did for two certain points.
Yes, and Rupert Murdoch is said to have a very close relationship with Donald Trump, and it's reflected in the New York Post in a certain way, and even in the Wall Street Journal in a certain way. Mm-hmm. What is that relationship about?
Well, it's funny that you said that, because they didn't really have a relationship before, not in the same way. I mean, they knew each other, and they were sort of friendly-ish. But the main relationship was really between Murdoch and his then-wife, Wendy Deng, and Ivanka Trump. Murdoch has always wanted to be an advisor to a president, and he certainly didn't have that with Bill Clinton, and he didn't really have it with Bush. You know, the Bush people didn't really have much use for him. So he saw the opportunity and jumped on it, and they now talk most days.
They talk most days. What about?
Mm-hmm. The economy, certain news stories, you know, what's happening in the world. I think Murdoch tries to keep Trump focused.
Who else does Trump talk to in that way? Who else outside the White House is a kind of consigliere from afar?
Oh, well, I can point you to a story that Glenn Thresh and I did on this about a month ago. There's a bunch of people. I mean, he talks to Sean Hannity a lot. Sean Hannity had an inexplicable freak out on Twitter when we reported it. But he is one of the people who Trump really does trust. He talks to Steve Schwartzman. There's a bunch of people, and then periodically for a time, but it was more really a Jared relationship, he was talking to Ron Lauder, you know, because Lauder was one of the only people who was telling him what he wanted to hear on the idea that a peace deal was possible with the Palestinians and Israel.
The Washington Post recently published a story saying that the president's allies are about to ramp up their fake news war by targeting specific reporters, that they'll look back through years of work in search of anything that can be fed to conservative media outlets and go about discrediting their work. Are you concerned that the nature of the personal attacks on you could get ratcheted up?
I mean, how much more worse could they get? It's been pretty bad.
Describe what they're like.
I mean, you know, there's... I think it's already pretty intense, and I think that what you talked about and what that Washington Post piece talked about describes a level of organization that certainly doesn't exist now. And if it does start to exist, then people should wonder who's paying for it.
Recently, some CNN reporters were getting death threat after death threat. Have you gotten this kind of harassment at home?
Yes, I have gotten anti-Semitic mail pieces to my home that I have had to try to keep out of my children's eyes. I've gotten a lot. I mean, but whatever. This also is, you know, this is what happens in the internet age.
It's mostly located on Twitter?
Most of it's located on Twitter or in my work email inbox. I do periodically get stuff at home, but short of moving, there's not really much I can do.
I've been lucky enough to have glimpses of watching you just kind of live your life for a few minutes at a time, and your phone does not stop. Your fingers do not leave the screen of your iPhone. You tweet with incredible regularity, which means that you're also reading a lot of things. And it's not an uncommon day to see your name as part of two, three, sometimes more stories. Tell me about this pace of life, what it does to your brain, how you work. What's your day like?
It's not great. You know how when you have a newborn, you feel as if you are living one long day.
Yeah.
So I feel as if I am living one long day. Look, I've done campaigns for years now. This is not, this is unlike that. Usually in a government, things settle down. after the first 3 months at the most. This is very different. You know, the day begins with getting my kids to school. Before that, I scan a couple of websites. I always look at the New York Post. It's the president's first read. Go to work. There's a list of people who I'm in frequent contact with.
Meaning you do a round of calls. You just call everybody that's on your...
Call or text or, you know,
what's
GChat.
Up?
Or, yeah, just, you know, what do you hear? What's going on?
Do those sources worry that they're being monitored?
Yes, everybody worries they're being monitored now.
They do. When did that happen? When did that start?
A couple of months ago.
Why? What set it off?
An enormous focus on leaks within the White House.
So do you communicate only on Signal as opposed to regular GChat?
I don't want to get into specifics of how I communicate with people, but I will say that people are concerned about being monitored.
And with reason?
I mean, I don't know that they have reason in the sense that I don't know that somebody's actually... Look, it's actually really hard, despite the president's tweets suggesting that you can wiretap someone with ease. You know, it's actually really difficult to do that. But I think that people feel hunted, and I think this White House has made public its anger and potential for venting that anger on people who speak.
Why doesn't anybody resign?
It's a great question that comes up a lot. I think for a few reasons. I think that people, you know, in some cases, people need to have it, you know, on their resumes that they withstood a certain amount of time. I think that some people really do believe that they are doing what's right for the country. And I think that other people are very personally loyal to the president. I think in some cases you have people who are afraid of quitting because they're afraid of how they're going to get trashed on the way out the door by rival factions in the White House.
Talk to me about Jared Kushner. He is in a unique position. This is a guy who saw his own father go to jail, and his rage about that, his sense of resentment, never really abates. Mm-hmm. Now he's in a position where he is included in this scandal. He's a son-in-law. It's hard for him to operate. He's incredibly entitled within the White House.
Yep.
And yet at the same time, probably fears leaving it.
I mean, I think that's absolutely true that he fears leaving it. I think that he's afraid that he will be, you know, targeted in a different way. I also think that if Jared Kushner were not related to the president, any other person with this fact set would have been fired in any other White House. So... you know, there is a reason why nepotism laws exist. To your point about Kushner's sense of grievance over his father's prosecution and being haunted by it and traumatized by it, that's absolutely true. Kushner has what many people in Trump's orbit have, which is a sense of huge misdirection. You know, he doesn't blame his father, and I can understand why that would be hard for a son to do. You know, it's the people who are to blame are the people who went after his father. And you hear that kind of thing a lot from the Trump White House grappling with other issues like Russia.
Who do they blame?
You know, the leakers or the Democrats or this one or that one. But it there's not much reflection on their own actions.
Do a lot of people in the West Wing not talk? Is there any discipline there in that sense?
There are plenty of people who are disciplined in the White House, and I wouldn't say that those who do talk are being undisciplined. I think that those who do talk, in some instances, are looking for a reality check. It's like therapy.
They're looking for therapy, not to shape the reality.
No, they're looking. Some of them are painfully aware that what is happening around them is quite unusual, and they are looking for somebody to validate that feeling.
Maggie, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Maggie Haberman, White House correspondent for The New York Times and an analyst for CNN. Later this hour, Bruce Eric Kaplan remembers the crazy TV specials of his youth, and we'll get some even crazier exercise tips from none other than Bob Odenkirk, the star of Better Call Saul. Stick around.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
WNYC Studios is supported by Rocket Money. Did you know nearly 75% of people have subscriptions they've forgotten about? Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills so that you can grow your savings. Rocket Money will even try to negotiate your bills for you by up to 20%. All you have to do is submit a picture of your bill, and Rocket Money takes care of the rest. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has saved a total of $500 million in canceled subscriptions, saving members up to $740 a year when using all of the app's features. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/WNYC. That's rocketmoney.com/WNYC.
I'm David Remnick, and this is the New Yorker Radio Hour. We're presenting today a remarkable story that appeared in The New Yorker 50 years ago, The Village of Ben Suk, a first-hand account of the Vietnam War by Jonathan Schell.
Inside the Chinook, many of the prisoners held their ears. Up front, on each side, a gunner wearing large earphones under a helmet scanned the countryside. The gunner's weapons pointed out. There was no guard inside the helicopter. A few of the prisoners, some bold and some just young, stood up and looked out the small portholes in the back of their seats. For the first time in their lives, they saw their land spread below them like a map, as the American pilots had always seen it. The tiny houses in the villages, the green fields along the river pockmarked with blue water-filled bomb craters, some blackened by napalm, and the dark green jungles splotched with long lines of yellow craters from B-52 raids. The trees around each crater splayed out in a star, like the orb of cracks around a bullet hole in glass.
When we talk about the Vietnam War, it still comes loaded with so many associations. It's the first war that America really lost. We talk about the atrocities committed by our soldiers at My Lai and elsewhere, and the problem of nation building, which is still very much with us in today's wars. But early in 1967, when Jonathan Schell landed in Vietnam for the first time, so much of that was still in the future. Schell was a college graduate who'd spent a year in Japan and wanted to see a little bit more of the world. He talked about his experience some 30 years later with a historian named Christian Oppie.
I had a ticket, a round-the-world ticket, that permitted me to stop anywhere I wanted on the way back around the world. So I decided that I would go to Vietnam. And with the idea of trying to write something, you know, I was the very definition of a pest. A graduate student who had no language there, who had no knowledge, and who vaguely thought he might like to write something. You know, just the definition of a nuisance. But I called up somebody that I'd met at Harvard called Francois Sully, who was a Frenchman and a reporter and was working for Newsweek at that time. And I called up the Newsweek office, and lo and behold, he was there and invited me over. Anyway, Sully and Bernard Fall were just these two ebullient, life-loving Frenchmen, you know, brilliant journalists both. And just out of sheer high spirits. They sort of took me up. This ignorant graduate student who scarcely said a word to paper. And eventually they performed a kind of miracle, which was they used their connections to persuade the military to give me a press pass on the somewhat deceptive basis that I was there for the Harvard Crimson. Yeah. So anyway, they got me this credential, an amazing gift from them. And then one day they called me up at my ratty hotel with lizards crawling on the ceiling and said, well, you know, something is going to happen. And it's all secret what it is, but you can go and see it if you want. So I said, okay.
So Jonathan Schell ended up a witness to Operation Cedar Falls, the largest ground operation of the Vietnam War. It brought overwhelming force to bear in stamping out Viet Cong control of an area known as the Iron Triangle.
And a very spiffy major, who had, as I recall, a kind of an easel with a board on it, disclosed to us that what we were there for was Operation Cedar Falls. And so there was this great menu of things, I mean, these things that they were going to do. They're going to bulldoze this forest, go in here, attack this, do that and the other. And there was, but one of the items on that list was the helicopter attack on the village of Ben Suk. So it occurred to me when we got to that item on the list, I said, well, what's going to happen to the village after it's attacked and so on. He said, well, we're going to destroy it. Move the people out. Not a My Lai, of course, but move the people out. And then we're going to, then what? I said, well, we're going to bulldoze it and bomb it. So I thought, okay, I'll just follow that particular story from start to finish.
The New Yorker devoted the better part of an entire issue to Jonathan Schell's article, The Village of Ben Suk.
Strings of 9 and 10 helicopters with tapered bodies could be seen through the treetops, filing across the gray early morning sky like little schools of minnows. In the distance, the slow beat of the engines sounded soft and almost peaceful, but when they rushed past overhead, the noise was fearful and deafening. By 7 o'clock, 60 helicopters were perched in formation on the airstrip, with 7 men assembled in a silent group beside each one.
I do recall one little act of cowardice when they asked which helicopter would I like to be on. And many of the journalists were clamoring to be on the first helicopter or the second helicopter. And I was delighted to be on helicopter number 46. It's okay with me to get there 10 seconds later.
When I arrived at the helicopter assigned to me, number 47, 3 engineers and 3 infantrymen were already there, 5 of them standing or kneeling in the dust checking their weapons. One of them, a sergeant, was a small, wiry American Indian who spoke in short, clipped syllables. The 6th man, a stocky infantryman with blonde hair and a red face who looked to be about 20 and was going into action for the first time, lay back against an earth embankment with his eyes closed, wearing an expression of boredom, as though he wanted to put these wasted minutes of waiting to some good use by catching up on his sleep.
There was terrible heat, I remember. It's awful to say it, but somehow I just remember that I was on this constant search for soft drinks. You know, this terrible, overwhelming heat, which I don't do well in.
The Huey flies with its doors open, so the men who sat on the outside seats were perched right next to the drop. They held tightly to the ceiling straps as the helicopter rolled and pitched through the sky like a ship plunging through a heavy sea. Below, the faces of scattered peasants were clearly visible as they looked from their water buffalo at the sudden, ear-splitting incursion of 60 helicopters charging low over their fields.
So this combination of this terrific heat, and of course the helmet and everything, and then this roller coastering that was going on made you, me, physically sick.
This is 1-3, roger out.
All at once, helicopter 47 landed, and from both sides of it, the men jumped out on the run into a freshly turned vegetable plot in the village of Ben Suk, the first Vietnamese village that several of them had ever set foot in. The houses were unusually set apart by hedges and low trees so that one house was only half visible from another and difficult to see from the road. They were not unlike a wealthy American suburb in the logic of their layout.
We sent another element down in there also. Thanks, Roger. Now, if you're getting...
Three or four soldiers began to search the houses behind a nearby copse. Stepping through the doorway of one house with his rifle in firing position at his hip, a solidly built, 6'2" Negro private came upon a young woman standing with a baby in one arm and a little girl of three or four holding her other hand. The woman was barefoot and dressed in a white shirt and rolled up black trousers. A bandana held her long hair in a coil at the back of her head. She and her children intently watched each of the soldiers' movements. In English, he asked, "Where's your husband?" Without taking her eyes off the soldier, the woman said something in Vietnamese in an explanatory tone. The soldier looked around in the inside of the one-room house and, pointing to his rifle, asked, "You have same-same?" The woman shrugged and said something else in Vietnamese. The soldier shook his head and poked his hand into a basket of laundry on a table between him and the woman. She immediately took all the laundry out of the basket and shrugged again with a hint of impatience, as though to say, "It's just laundry." The soldier nodded and looked around, appearing unsure of what to do next in this situation. Then, on a peg on one wall, he spotted a pair of men's pants and a shirt hanging up to dry. "Where's he?" he asked, pointing to the clothes. The woman spoke in Vietnamese. The soldier took the damp clothing down and, for some reason, carried it outside where he laid it on the ground. After a minute, the private came back in with a bared machete at his side and a field radio on his back. "Where's your husband, huh?" he asked again. This time, the woman gave a long answer in a complaining tone in which she pointed several times at the sky and several times at her children. The soldier looked at her blankly. "What do I do with her?" he called to his fellow soldiers outside. There was no answer. Turning back to the young woman who had not moved since his first entrance, he said, "Okay, lady, you stay here," and left the house.
Well, I got along very well with the soldiers and their officers, and I liked them very much. And you have to bear in mind that at that time there wasn't the sort of endemic suspicion that later grew up. And if you had a press pass in Vietnam, it was a free travel ticket all over the country. You could hitchhike rides on helicopters and transport planes wherever you wanted. It was a meal ticket. It was a hotel reservation anywhere. And there was a fantastic, not only support, but freedom at that time to see what you wanted to see.
The sky, which had been overcast, began to show streaks of blue, and a light wind stirred the trees. The bombing, the machine gunning from helicopters, and shelling, and the rocket firing continued steadily. Suddenly, a Vietnamese man on a bicycle appeared, pedaling rapidly along the road from the direction of the village. He was wearing the collarless, pajama-like black garment that is both the customary dress of the Vietnamese peasant and the uniform of the National Liberation Front. And although he was riding away from the center of the village, a move forbidden by the voices in the helicopter, he had, it appeared, already run a long gauntlet of American soldiers without being stopped. But when he had ridden about 20 yards past the point where he first came into sight, there was a burst of machine gun fire from a copse 30 yards in front of him, joined immediately by a burst from a vegetable field to one side, and he was hurled off his bicycle into a ditch a yard from the road. The bicycle crashed into a side embankment. The Vietnamese in the ditch appeared to be about 20, and he lay on his side without moving, blood flowing from his face, which, with his eyes open, was half buried in the dirt at the bottom of the ditch. The two men, both companions of mine on number 47, stood still for a while with folded arms and stared down at the dead man's face, as though they were giving him a chance to say something. Then the engineer said with a tone of finality, "That's a VC for you." He's a VC, all right. That's what they wear. He was leaving town. He had to have some reason.
I didn't have preconceived ideas when I arrived in Vietnam. And my understanding of the war really came out of the shock of experience. And initially seeing that on the ground and in the details, it was not making sense. You see, at home, the reporting was conditioned by the story as it had been understood in Washington and in the United States. And therefore, the American public was not acquainted with the fact that we were just were destroying villages and clearing the people out of there, because that hadn't been considered a fact worthy of notice.
At about 9 o'clock, people from the outlying areas of the village began to appear on the road, walking toward the village center and bringing with them as many pieces of furniture, bicycles, pots, chickens, pigs, cows, ducks, and water buffalo as they could carry or herd along. One woman carried a shoulder pole with her belongings balanced in a basket hanging on one end and a baby sitting in a basket on the other end. This procession, like the appearance of the houses, made it plain that Ben Suk was a wealthy village. Most of the villagers wore clean, unpatched clothing. The children had rosy cheeks and stout limbs. The cows were fat and sleek, and a great number of pigs and chickens were left rooting and pecking in the deserted yards. At 3:45, the male captives between ages 15 and 45 were marched to the edge of the helicopter pad, where they squatted in two rows with a guard at each end. They hid their faces in their arms as the Chinook double-rotor helicopter set down, blasting them with dust. The back end of the helicopter lowered to form a gangplank, leading to a dark, square opening. Their captive cards flapping around their necks, the prisoners ran, crouching low under the whirling blades, into the dim interior. Immediately, the gangplank drew up, and the fat, bent banana shape of the Chinook rose slowly from the field. The women and children braved the gale to watch its rise, but appeared to lose interest in its flight long before it disappeared over the trees. It was as though their fathers, brothers, and sons had ceased to exist when they ran into the roaring helicopter.
The whole thing, as I say, was a kind of superimposition of an alien and fictitious reality on the real situation of Vietnam. And so we would do something to somebody and then they would become that thing. I mean, starting with the fact that a VC could be identified by the fact that we had killed him. If we attacked a population and maybe weren't killing them, but we were going to destroy their village and move them onto a dusty field, then by definition, they were a hostile population. At least we were hostile to them, that was for sure. So when you have that kind of power, it's like a power of definition.
Just beyond the border of the 50-yard demolition, a number of tiny huts still stood in a grove of tall trees sloping down to the rice fields along the river. The little girls appeared to be sisters, about 9 and 12 years old. They were barefoot, wore simple, short, beltless dresses, and had their black hair in long braids. A few yards away from them, a very old man and a woman watched us approach. When we arrived, no one seemed quite sure how to deal with the situation. Then the two little girls took charge. Speaking slowly and clearly and repeating everything several times, they informed a major who had attended 6 weeks of language school that their parents had been taken away in a truck, and that they now wished to load their rice and furniture into a truck and go themselves. They laughed freely when the major failed at first to understand them. Without waiting for a response, they beckoned to us to follow them. One of the officers muttered, "Better watch it. Could be a trap." But the others followed the little girls. Upon reaching one of the huts, the girls hoisted onto their shoulders sacks of rice that I thought would surely crush them, and pointed to things for us to carry. One of the almost full bags of rice was open at the top. The younger sister gave me a handful of straw, indicating that I was to tie it closed. She watched me fumble for a minute, and then took the straw from my hands and expertly twisted it around the top of the bag in a way that made it secure. They insisted on bringing a large jar full of rice that could be carried only when it was suspended by its wire handles from a pole, and there was a person at each end to man the pole. I took one end, and the sisters took the other, and we had just started toward the jeep when the pole snapped and the jar fell, without overturning on the ground. The little girls burst out laughing, and it was a full 15 seconds before the elder sister ran back for another pole. One of the officers said that he had found a rowboat and wanted to blow it up with a hand grenade. While he was performing this mission, the other Americans loaded the rice on the truck and hoisted up the girls and the aged couple, who had fetched a few bundles themselves by this time. Holding their sleeves over their mouths against the dust, they set out down the road for Phu Lai. The officer who had gone to attend to the rowboat returned after an explosion had sounded from the woods, and reported that, to his surprise, the hand grenade had blown only a 6-inch hole in the bottom of the skiff.
I can tell you one thing that happened when I went back in the summer of 67, that the village of Ben Suk was coming out in the New Yorker, and they faxed the whole damn thing over to Vietnam, and it was spewing out while I was there a second time. People were reading it and commenting to me. And they were pleased with it. And I met some of the people who were described in it, and they felt it was an accurate representation, and they were very happy with what I'd written because they felt it did accurately reflect what was going on there. Of course, back in the United States, that same article was profoundly shocking to a lot of people. You know, one thing that struck me very powerfully was the capacity, both for not so much the enlisted man, but for the officer corps and the press corps, to see things in terms of a story that they brought with them, and not to see what was actually going on the ground under their noses.
At Phu Lai, truckloads of villagers from the north end of the triangle and from Ben Suk continued to arrive in front of the little row of huts in the huge field. On the first day, over 1,000 people were brought in. When they climbed slowly down from the backs of the trucks, they had lost their appearance of healthy villagers and taken on the passive, dull-eyed, waiting expression of the uprooted. It was impossible to tell whether the deadness and discouragement had actually replaced a spark of sullen pride in their expression and bearing, or whether it was just that any crowd of people removed from the dignifying context of their homes and places of labor, learning, and worship, and dropped, tired, and coated with dust in a bare field, would appear broken-spirited to an outsider. At the moment that the Ben Suk villagers got off the trucks at Phu Lai, the military plan that had started with the attack on Ben Suk and had proceeded precisely on schedule came to an end.
I mean, what you could say about the village of Ben Suk is that the operation came off beautifully. It worked exactly as planned. The helicopters flew into the village, they land there, they quickly quelled the resistance, moved the people out, destroyed the village, mission accomplished. But to what end? Did that advance any goal that the United States had in mind? No, it set us back. I mean, the more we won there, the more we lost. That was the paradox of Vietnam. So the more we'd win on the battlefield, and we did just about every day and just about every battle, the more we lost the political war, because the more helpless that society was to the North and to the NLF.
The demolition teams arrived in Ben Suk on a clear, warm day after the last boatload of animals had departed down the river for Phu Gong. GIs moved down the narrow lanes into the sunny, quiet yards of the empty village, pouring gasoline on the grass roofs of the houses and setting them afire with torches. Columns of black smoke boiled up briefly into the blue sky as the dry roofs and walls burned to the ground, exposing little indoor tableaus of charred tables and chairs, broken cups and bowls, an occasional bed, and the ubiquitous bomb shelters. Before the flames had died out in the spindly black frames of the houses, bulldozers came rolling through the copses of palms, uprooting the trees as they proceeded, lowering their scoops to scrape the packed mud foundations bare. When the bulldozers hit the heavy walls of the bomb shelters, they whined briefly at a higher pitch, but continued to press ahead, unchecked. There were very few dwellings in Ben Suk to make a bulldozer pause. When the demolition teams withdrew, they had flattened the village, but the original plan for the demolition had not yet run its course. Faithful to the initial design, Air Force jets sent their bombs down on the deserted ruins, scorching again the burned foundation of the houses and pulverizing for a second time the heaps of rubble in hopes of collapsing tunnels too deep and well hidden for the bulldozers to crush. As though, having once decided to destroy it, we were now bent on annihilating every possible indication that the village of Ben Suk had ever existed.
The village of Ben Suk. It appeared in The New Yorker in July of 1967. Noah Averback Katz read the excerpts from Jonathan Schell's article. Schell went on to a long career at The New Yorker and became a leading advocate for nuclear disarmament. He died in 2014. The interview that we heard was Schell talking to historian Christian Oppie. They spoke in 1999, and the tape was provided to us in connection with LBJ's War, an oral history produced by PRI.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour, and now, ladies and gentlemen, Bob Odenkirk.
Hi, Bob Odenkirk here. I'm an actor, but I'm also a middle-aged white guy and a dad. Now, you're probably wondering where I got these amazing abs. They're so ripply and rock hard, they're difficult to fathom. My perturbed, puffy face sets you up for a blubbery gut. But then you see these abs, stacked like bricks, and you have to ask, does he work out for 2 or 3 hours a day, or does he just work out all the time? Or perhaps you think I purchased them from a plastic surgeon in Beverly Hills.
No way!
No, my secret is simple. Dynamic tension. Tension that is tense and dynamic and never-ending. The best kind of tension there is.
Dynamic tension.
I have analyzed each ab and where it draws its tension from so that you too can get the abs you've always dreamed of. The ab on the upper right is taut and sinewy thanks to middle school.
Middle school.
Specifically, the effort of trying to get my two kids placed in a top-notch middle school. It's a lot of work, and I'm there every step of the way, leaning over their shoulders, looking down. That's what tightens the ab. Swallowing hard, also good for the ab, and clenching and unclenching my fists. That's good for the fists.
Nice ab, Dad!
Thanks, kids. Dad loves you, and Dad loves the ab you've given him. The middle right ab bulges handsomely. That's thanks to Talk Radio.
Talk Radio.
I simply tune in to conservative talkers when I'm driving, and my screaming at the host tightens this ab for an extended, uninterrupted rep all day long.
Obama? What kind of world do you want to live in? You want to live behind
the upper left ab pops out impressively from the effort of lugging 5-gallon water jugs into our kitchen. Actually, the lugging, it does nothing for the ab. It's that one moment where you have to tip the full jug into the dispensing reservoir without spilling. That strains and sculpts this beautiful ab.
Tip the jug!
Afterward, slipping on the spilled water, that can be great for a full body clench. The bottom right ab, the biggest of all my abs, and therefore the most impressive, is from not having sex.
Celibacy.
This is a real secret secret. The ab is quietly tensed at all times. It has been for years now. Can you imagine the Pope's lower right ab? That must be huge.
The Pope is celibate.
I, however, did not take a vow of chastity, so this would be a sad situation if it didn't yield such an amazing ab. Finally, you've got to appreciate my extra abs. That's right, I have 2 abs more than most people. They're in my lower back, and I'll admit it, they were put there by a Beverly Hills plastic surgeon. I was told they're the latest thing. God, I hope so. They hurt like hell.
Where I Got These Abs, Now You Know. That was the writer and actor Bob Odenkirk performing a piece he wrote for The New Yorker. Odenkirk was just nominated for an Emmy for Better Call Saul. Now, in the office here, hanging up all around the halls, we've got blow-ups of great cartoons published in The New Yorker over the decades. They're fun. Visitors love them, but I guess for the cartoonists themselves, sometimes they can be a little weird.
I passed one of my cartoons in the hallway, and, you know, it's this man and a woman fighting, and they're so blocky. Once someone said my cartoon characters are fat, I thought it was a very pejorative thing to say about my people. But anyhow, the one thing that I do notice when I walk by this image of these two people fighting is, like, it's the most unsexy world. I still can't access sexiness in cartoons at all. Even when I write TV shows, I can only really write a bad sex scene.
That's Bruce Eric Kaplan, who's not only a cartoonist of amazingly unsexy people, but a TV writer with quite a list of credits to his name. Seinfeld, 6 Feet Under, and Girls. Kaplan's calling as a writer began in New Jersey, in the suburbs, where he lived what he calls a normal childhood, which is to say, hours upon hours upon hours of television.
When I watched TV, it was like I was living. I was seeing what life was. Life was about, like, connection and banter and wit and passion.
From Television City in Hollywood, ladies and gentlemen, Sonny and Cher.
In the summer, every now and then, a summer variety show would come on. And that was so great because these summer variety shows were just not as produced, looser. The outfits would be lower. You would see more cleavage on the women, like Cher's cleavage. I mean, Cher's cleavage was so intense when you were a kid. I don't remember anything analogous to it.
Cher is the sex symbol of the show, and it's structured that way. I mean, you can see everything.
So I still can't believe. Like, why were you allowed to see that?
I'm sure there are some men who find you sexy. I'm sure there are some men who find you sexy.
And then you would see that during the summer, and then in the fall you'd go back to Carol Burnett, and she had her, like, dress up to here, you know. Same costumer, by the way, Bob Mackie. It was like Bob Mackie went crazy during the summer.
Did you say I've got a lot to learn?
So much I can't tell you.
Don't you think I'm trying not to learn?
Since this is a perfect spot to learn. Teach me tonight.
Woo!
I was, you know, addicted to television. Television is how I learned about life. It was like my third parent. Because my parents didn't teach me anything. That was how I learned what life was. During the year, I was an enormous Carol Burnett fan, watched it every week, and I remember one summer, the Melba Moore Clifton Davis show appeared instead of a rerun of the Carol Burnett show.
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to our first show of the summer season.
Hey, how about a good luck kiss?
Now, honey, not in front of millions of people.
I am not ashamed of the way I feel about you. I have nothing to hide, so lay it on me.
Oh, no, my mama told me about boys like you.
And they were this couple. I guess he was an actor and she was a singer.
Whew. Now, that is a kiss. Mm-hmm. Now, tell me, didn't your hands tremble and your legs go weak?
Yeah, but I might have the flu.
You know what someone really showed me? Is no, honey, if you let your guard down, things could be great. I never really understood my parents' relationship. There didn't seem to be a real ease between them a lot of the time. And I was scared. When I looked at my parents, I was scared that, like, oh, my God, that's what a relationship is. That's scary. And then when I would look at TV, I would be like, oh, that's what a relationship could be like. I would study things on TV like Melba Moore and Clifton Davis and be like, a relationship could be fun. These people are having fun. They're having a good time. Like, the last thing my parents had was a good time.
When I was 15 and my family came to the island for the summer, there weren't nearly as many houses or people as there are now.
Television taught me about relationships, and I guess then it taught me about sex. I think I plotted watching Summer of 42. I think I read the description, and I was like, I need to see this. And I saw it was on at 11:45 and went down to watch it. It felt like a memoir because it had a narrator named Hermie, and it was in the first person about the Summer of 42 when the writer was a teenager, like in some summer place, like a beach community. And he and his two best friends, they fixated on this young woman who was married, whose husband was away at war.
And that house up there, that was her house.
The narrator befriends her.
And nothing from that first day I saw her, and no one that has happened to me since,
covered in goosebumps,
has ever been as frightening and as confusing.
She's very upset one night and they have sex. And then you find out there was a letter that her husband had died in the war. And that she turned to Hermie for comfort. It was so mind-blowing, the idea that you were 14 or so and you could have sex. You could have sex with an adult woman. I'm a parent, and you would think, looking back on this now, I would be horrified, but it was so specific a story. It was like the Summer of 42 could just happen once in the world. This was it. You were seeing the one time someone this young could sleep with this beautiful woman. And even if you look at the title, it's the Summer of 42. It's not 42. Summer is when something crazy can happen. When I was a kid, I loved the TV so much that I wanted to crawl inside of it. And I think, you know, when I became a TV writer, I actually did. I got to be on the other side. I get to be in the TV when I'm on a set. But what I just realized in thinking about these summer variety shows and things I would watch during the summer is that I moved to Los Angeles. When I was 21, I moved to Los Angeles. It's Always Summer.
Bruce Eric Kaplan, writer and cartoonist in Los Angeles. Next week on the show, the country singer George Strait. One of the great hit makers of all time. He sits down with The New Yorker's Kelefasani. Don't miss it. And for today, that's it. Thanks for tuning in. Hope you enjoyed the show. And I hope you'll listen next week as well.
Amarillo by morning, up from San Antonio. Everything that I got is just what I've got on.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Merrill Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.